Hello, and welcome once again to the St Albans and District Talking Newspaper, serving St Albans, Harfenden and surrounding villages. This is the News Extra edition for the week ending Saturday the 29th of August 2020. My name is Steve and I edit and produce this programme. In this programme we'll have our usual roundup of news stories from the current editions of the Hearts Advertiser and St Albans Review. We'll also have our selection of national radio highlights coming up in the next week, which will be read by John. Then we have David Ireson, this time describing what he calls Gregory's Gift. Finally, we'll have this week's birthdays and events this week in past times. This week's music is called Travel Light and is by Gothby. So now the news, and our readers today are Terry, Leslie, Wendy and myself.
Hello, this is Wendy. And my first story is West Hertfordshire Hospital Site Review Published. An independent report has concluded redeveloping Watford General Hospital is the only realistic way forward for a trust which has millions to spend on its facilities. A review of four Greenbelt sites for a new hospital in West Hertfordshire has found a hospital trust would face complex challenges during the planning process and struggle to meet a government redevelopment deadline of 2025. West Hertfordshire Hospital's NHS Trust could have as much as £590 million to spend on improving its facilities. Campaigners want to see a new hospital built on a site that is collectively accessible to Watford, Hemel Hempstead and St Albans. The Trust has consistently stated that the construction of a new hospital would be too expensive and last year confirmed its preferred way forward is to spend the bulk of the funding on refurbishing and upgrading Watford General Hospital. Nevertheless, the Trust has not ruled out the option of building a new hospital, but the findings of the site review will not make good reading for new hospital campaigners. This is because it has been deemed very unlikely any hospital could be completed on a new site by 2025. The Hospital Trust commissioned Royal Free London Property Services to undertake a site feasibility review of four greenfield sites, along with two additional options at or next to Watford General. The independent review by RFL, Montague Evans and Currian Brown will be used by the Trust in its appraisal of different site options. The primary purpose of the review was to independently assess and determine the programme to bring forward a health facility for the Trust, taking into account potential hurdles such as land availability, timings and costs. The six sites that have been reviewed are Kings Langley, land east of the A41 at Junction 20 for the M25. Leverstock Green, the eastern side of Hemel Hempstead South near the Gorhambury Estate. Chiswell Green, the land off Junction 21A for the M25. Park Street, the former Radlett Airfield. Watford General Hospital, Vicarage Road, Watford. And Watford Riverwell, the land next to Watford General Hospital. With regard to costs, construction works have been calculated. However, there is too much uncertainty over costs of building new roads or junctions in particular, so final costing figures have not been generated. The authors of the report say the report demonstrates that the greenfield options carry far greater risk and complexity compared to the Watford General Hospital site options. The Trust will consider the review and put together a shortlist of redevelopment options based on its findings. The shortlist is expected to be published in October. The Trust will then prepare its outline business case, which will detail its final proposal and which option it has chosen. This business case is expected to be submitted in autumn 2021. Dwayne Passman, the Trust's recently appointed Acute Redevelopment Programme Director, said, "Having been involved in many hospital builds over several decades, I know how important it is to start with the best possible options. This study provides an impartial basis for our next stage, and I am grateful to those involved for their thorough approach. He went on to say, I know that people feel strongly about the issue of where the new hospital buildings will be located. We will need to look at the evidence because we have a once-in-a-generation opportunity to transform our hospital buildings and provide our communities with great facilities. He said, thankfully, we are developing more ways for patients to access care without coming to an emergency hospital site, and so location will be less of an issue as we move more and more services online or into local settings. Whilst we can't please everyone, we can absolutely give our assurance that we will base our decisions on good evidence and will press on so that we can bring about real and lasting benefits for our patients. We continue to work towards having new buildings open in 2025 or as soon as possible after that date.
Hello, Steve here. My first story is fraudsters are posing as police to con St. Albans residents. Police are warning residents to stay vigilant following reports of scam phone calls to homes in the St. Albans area. Five victims have received calls this month from fraudsters posing as police officers claiming that they are investigating fraud offences involving the victim's bank account. The bogus police officer asked the victims to withdraw cash for a collection by a courier. Fraudsters may ask the victims to call back on 999 101 or 161 to verify that they are genuinely a police officer. However, this is part of the scam. They keep the line open so the victim continues to speak to the fraudster, believing that they are genuine officials. Detective Inspector Rob Burns from Hertfordshire Constabulary's Serious Fraud and Cyber Unit said, "These fraudsters use a variety of different scams, often changing their stories. Sometimes they offer money, other times it may be vouchers or even the victim's bank card. They tend to target elderly people and can be extremely convincing and intimidating. It's important to remember that police officers and bank officials will never ask you to withdraw money, purchase goods, or hand over private banking details. Please help us to raise awareness by talking about this with your family and friends, especially if they are vulnerable or elderly. If you believe you are the victim of a scam, call the police on 101 using a different phone to that used to communicate with the fraudsters. If a fraud is in process or someone's life is in danger, call 999 immediately. Hertfordshire Constabulary offers the following crime prevention advice. Be sceptical of callers, even those who claim to be officials. Don't be afraid to put the phone down with a brief no thank you. Never give personal information, such as your date of birth or bank details, to unexpected callers. Remember that the police or your bank would never unexpectedly call you and ask you to withdraw cash or move money to another account as a result of fraud or any other reason. If callers suggest you call your local police or bank to check who they are, use another phone or ensure the line has been fully disconnected by phoning a friend or relative first, or by waiting at least 5 minutes. Otherwise, you may think you've phoned a number, but you're simply talking to the fraudsters again. This is a common fraudster's tactic. If a caller asks you to type your bank PIN numbers into your telephone handset, do not do this, as fraudsters can use technology to identify the numbers. And you can opt out of many cold calls by registering for free with the Telephone Preference Service on 0845 070-0707.
Hello, my name is Terry, and my first article is headlined, Funding is now announced for second footbridge at City Station. Funding has been earmarked by the Transport Secretary for a second footbridge at St. Albans City Station, alongside the announcement of a new acceleration unit, which aims to speed up transport infrastructure across the UK post-COVID. The unit brings a wave of funding for rail and highway projects across the UK. The funding for St. Albans Station will aid the completion of the 6.4 million scheme to build the new second footbridge. The footbridge will serve all four platforms and should ease congestion and address safety issues at the busy station. Work is due to start on this in early 2021 and should be delivered by January 2022. The funding follows an announcement last year that Network Rail would be building the second footbridge after the completion of Govia Thames Link Railway's revamp of the station, which is ongoing. Thames Link Customer Services Director Jenny Saunders said, "This second footbridge will be an added real bonus for commuters, saving them time queuing to get on and off the platforms, in particular the Central Island platform, which becomes very crowded in normal times. We look forward to working closely with Network Rail to develop the scheme." St Albans City is Thames Link's busiest station north of London, with more than 7.5 million people passing through its gates in the 12 months to April 2019, a 2.6% rise on the year before, attributed to the extra services and longer trains Thames Link has introduced. Stephen Hind, Head of Business Development for Network Rail, said, "We welcome the announcement of fundings to build a new footbridge at St Albans City Station. The footbridge will bring significant benefits. It will reduce crowding in the station at peak times and make it easier for rail users to move around the station and access the platforms." Welwyn Hatfield MP and Transport Secretary Grant Shapps said, "We want to accelerate Britain's recovery by investing in vital infrastructure that will help get businesses back on their feet, create jobs to replace those that have been lost, and level up our country. The creation of our new acceleration unit and investment in our roads and railways will ensure we build back better, greener, and faster in the future." There's a photograph of the exterior of the current St Albans City Station, which has been newly refurbished and sparkling in its new colours.
Fly tippers dump oil to flood road for 400 metres. Used motor oil containers have been dumped in a country lane in Wheathampstead, with the weekend weather washing engine oil as far as a quarter of a mile down the road. Residents alerted their ward councillor for the area, Sandra Wood, who visited Sheepcot Lane on Sunday, August the 16th. The oil had been dumped about 300 metres south of where Sheepcot Lane connects with Codicott Lane. Sheepcot Lane is an unmade and unlit byway that connects Codicott Lane to Marford Road in Wheathampstead. It is open to all vehicles and it has often been a target for fly tippers in the past. Councillor Wood told the Hearts Ad, "This incident is particularly bad. There looks to have been over 30 oil containers and two full-size oil drums dumped on the site. It looks like somebody has been clearing out a commercial garage site. What has made this incident far worse is that it looks like the perpetrators didn't just dump the containers. They removed the caps off the containers and poured the oil out into the lane. The rain over the weekend has washed the oil over a quarter of a mile down the lane, causing major pollution. There may have been as much as 2,000 litres of oil dumped in the lane. In addition to the used oil, garden decking with a distinctive grey paint has also been fly-tipped in the lane, alongside white picket fencing." A spokesman for St Albans District Council said, "We are in the process of clearing up the lane, but some of the containers and liquid may be hazardous. The area has been cordoned off. It might not just be oil, it might be something else. We've got to be very careful with health and safety, and we can't say for sure that it is oil. We have a third-party contractor coming in to remove the bottles shortly. The timber is in the process of being removed by our waste contractor, Veolia. As the area is not easily acceptable, special arrangements have to be made. It should all be cleared by the end of the week. We haven't seen any evidence as to who is responsible or where it has come from, but if we find any, we will pursue the perpetrators.
Ashes stolen in burglary. A family has been left devastated after their father-in-law's ashes were stolen in a robbery in Coney Heath while his widow was in hospital. The Watford General patient had left her house on Friday afternoon, and between 12:45 p.m. on Saturday afternoon and 9:30 a.m. on Sunday, the Coney Heath Lane home was broken into. The house was ransacked and two gold necklaces, a mahogany box containing ashes, and two half-sovereign coins are believed to have been stolen. Alison Martin, the victim's daughter-in-law, said, "We're just gutted. My father-in-law spent a long time collecting the sovereign coins. But most of all, it's the ashes. We lost him 6 years ago, and it has been difficult to move on. I just don't know how to tell my mother-in-law." The family hope with the public's help they can recover the casket which contains the ashes. I'm sure they don't realise what they've taken. Because it's sealed, they must have thought it was valuables, and I think they'll just dump it. But I do hope this appeal will speak to their conscience. All my mother-in-law wants is her husband back, and she clutches to those ashes. So if people could keep a lookout near hedges and the side of the road, as people are walking and cycling a lot more now. It could be left in a stolen car, but if you see it, please hand it in. If you did take the casket in the burglary, Alison is also appealing for your help in returning it safely and anonymously, and you can do so by getting in touch with this newspaper. The box has a mahogany colour, a gold decoration running on its side with gold-like handles, and is sealed and has a casket shape. It also has Gerald Sidney Martin written on the side, along with his date of birth, January 10, 1929, and the date of death, October 22, 2014. If you find the casket or know where it is, you can contact us on 07841 490 610. Anyone with information should call 101, quoting crime reference 41/67514/20.
Hertfordshire Business Mentoring Scheme launched to help recovery after lockdown. Hearts businesses are being offered a free lifeline in the form of a personal mentor, thanks to the Volunteer Business Support Scheme launched by the Hertfordshire Growth Hub, University of Hertfordshire, and funded by the Hertfordshire Local Enterprise Partnership. The free support is being delivered until the end of the year by a team of 40 volunteer business advisors. Businesses are matched with a mentor who acts as a critical friend. Mentor Alec Campbell, former St Albans District Council leader, says, "I wanted to help local businesses address their immediate challenges and survive. However, it is also very much about helping business take stock and develop plans to achieve longer-term growth plans and goals." Alec is mentoring Ben Cooper of A&D Electrical Services Limited, who explained, "Our commercial work dried up overnight, questioning the company's viability and leading us to apply for this scheme. The support we received has been excellent. We've developed a new sales and marketing plan. We are focusing on the educational sector, helping to maintain electrical safety and emergency lighting compliance. We've developed a robust test and record management system, which allows us to update and renew electrical infrastructures to a high standard." Another local mentor, Rachel Sheridan from Harpenden, is working with Caroline Sison from Pocket PA, an innovative and powerful business-in-a-box app for self-employed business people to keep on top of bookings, invoicing and cash flow. Caroline launched her business in January. She said, "This has been an incredibly difficult time. I really needed the expertise of an experienced mentor to help guide and support Pocket PA. Thankfully, I've been matched with Rachel, who has given excellent suggestions and advice to help steer us through. Paul Isink from Phenomisalt.com has been matched to a client who has an impairment, which means verbal communication is not possible, so has been using an online whiteboard program to help overcome the obstacle. If you're interested in being matched with a mentor for your business, go to https://www.hearts.ac.uk/business/business-support-volunteers.
My next article is headlined, "A True Community Hero, Post Office Manager Saluted for Lockdown Work." A post office manager has been recognised for her efforts during lockdown as part of the We're Stronger Together Awards. Raj Kaur, who has run Watford Road Post Office in Chiswell Green for 20 years, received a special commendation from PO bosses during an online event for Greater London. The We're Stronger Together Awards recognise postmasters' efforts to stay open during the pandemic and to continue serving their community. When lockdown began, Raj visited those facing difficulties with a potted flower and a message reading, "Be careful, be safe," along with her contact details. She also created special badges which said, "Thinking of you," which she posted to customers' doors. She offered free deliveries from the convenience store which she has run with her husband Alan for the past 32 years. Group Chief Executive Nick Reed, who presented the award virtually, said, "Raj's branch stayed open full time during lockdown, and she kept spirits up by delivering messages and potted flowers to shielding and bereaved customers. Raj is chair of the local residents' association and is loved by the local community, which is reflected in the brilliant feedback she always receives all the time." Raj said, "Postmasters have become a great hub of their communities. I just did what comes naturally to me and simply made a heartfelt contribution to those in considerable need. I wish to thank everyone who nominated me and gave me this award. But I'm sure many others also deserve to share this as well. I have been blessed and lucky to live in this village. I feel as though I am part of one big family. The pandemic has caused uncertainty and sadness, but it has brought the community even closer together." Area manager Simon Stracey added, "Raj appears to be loved by every single member of her local community. It's not hard to see why. She's so dedicated and caring. I've already had over 100 customer feedback responses for Raj this year, all positive. And there are two delightful pictures, one of Raj holding a beautiful bouquet of flowers next to a gentleman holding up her community engagement award, and two gentlemen from the post office, I assume, who presented it to her. And another photograph showing her outside the shop with a dozen or more very contented looking customers waving in appreciation of all her efforts."
Rainbow Trails organiser Preet is honoured as Hero of Hertfordshire. Preet Cox, organiser of the ever-growing and popular St Albans Rainbow Trail, has been honoured with a prestigious Hero of Hertfordshire Award. Preet began the Rainbow Trails group at the start of the coronavirus lockdown to help boost people's mood, show appreciation for our key workers, and spread positivity. Since then, the group has flourished, with more than 2,000 members online, and has gone on to raise money for various hearts-based charities. Preet told the Hearts ad, "I am truly honoured to have received the Hero of Hertfordshire Award as a token of thanks for the work I've done through the St Albans Rainbow Trail community group. It was such a lovely surprise and something which has been a highlight for me during this difficult year with the pandemic and lockdown. It's great to be recognised outside of being a mum and work too. I've seen many other individuals, charities, organisations and community groups receive the Hero of Hertfordshire Award, and it's really inspiring to see. The award, given by the Lord Lieutenant of Hertfordshire, Robert Voss, recognises residents and organisations which have done something special for the community during the COVID-19 lockdown. It's an absolute pleasure to organise events within such a creative community. The best part of the community group is seeing the diverse talent, creativity and kindness people show and share with one another while they take part in the events, and this brings with it a feeling of solidarity within our community, which is wonderful. Preet is currently planning a new trail for the first 2 weeks of September, when children go back to school. She said, "The initiative aims to help ease some of the anxieties and stresses children and parents will be facing as children and young people return to schools and higher education through artwork in windows and a potential competition. I'm hoping the trail will help make those journeys to school and back a little more fun, uplifting and positive. This will also be a fundraising initiative." Most recently, the Rainbow Trails group raised money for Home Start Hearts with a Hope the Hippo competition. Money can still be donated to the cause at ukvirginmoneygiving.com/PreetCox1.
St Albans Charter Market Trader shortlisted for National Award. An eco-friendly market trader has won through to the final of a prestigious national award. Danny Jefferson, 24, who trades as Jefferson Crafts at the twice-weekly St Albans Charter Market, is in the running for the title of Young Market Trader of the Year. She set up her stall 18 months ago after being made redundant from her retail job, selling eco-friendly products for bathrooms and kitchens that she makes at home from sustainable and reusable materials. Her range includes wash bags, makeup wipes, towels, bowl covers, dishcloths, and soap holders. Danny will travel to Stratford-upon-Avon this weekend to compete in the socially distanced final against 50 other traders aged 16 to 30 for the title, which is handed out by the National Market Traders Federation. The winner will receive £500 and the chance to enhance their profile, with last year's winner being featured on BBC TV's One Show. Cotton Mill resident Danny, who has already won the regional final for London and the South East, said, "I would be over the moon if I landed the national title too. This business started out as a little sideline, but when I lost my job, I threw everything into it, became a regular market trader, and have not looked back. I love the whole experience of working at the market and am committed to making and selling products that are kind to the environment. It has been tough during the COVID lockdown, of course, but I'm very confident Jefferson Crafts will continue to grow as things settle down, and winning the title would be a great boost." Councillor Mandy McNeil, portfolio holder for Business, Tourism and Culture, will be going to the final to cheer on Danny. "She is a wonderful example of the opportunities that our charter market can give to young local entrepreneurs who want to set up their own business. She has given it a go and made a huge success of it. This is the second major award that the market has been shortlisted for in recent weeks. We have also been nominated for the title of the UK's Best Food Market 2020 at the Great British Food Awards."
Football Initiative returns post-lockdown with tournament for young people. The return of youth football following lockdown has prompted a voluntary organisation to kick off with a new community tournament. Kickoff at 3 is a St Albans-based initiative founded by two passionate Hearts residents to encourage engagement with children of all ages through the power of sports and music. Michael Wallace and Ashley Levine aim to raise awareness and funds for a range of charities that promote health and well-being while fostering positive long-term relationships between vulnerable young people and the local police. They have been organising community and nationwide events since 2017, and their latest football tournament will be taking place on Saturday, September 12th at the Cotlandswick Leisure Centre in London Coney. This will be the first meeting since the COVID-19 lockdown. The five-a-side tournament is aimed at all local teams from the 14 to 16 age group, and St Albans Chartered Accountants Rayna Essex have made a donation for prizes for contestants. Co-founder Michael, a serving police officer who works in community and youth engagement and is a governor for London Coney Primary School, said, "The lockdown massively affected those people with health issues. Because of that, I felt we still had to do something as safely as possible, with the key thing being getting outside and being active. Kickoff at 3 usually runs a nationwide football tournament, which had to be cancelled, so this will be the first event they have run this year, and they are keen to make it a competition to remember." Michael added, "This will be the perfect opportunity for local football sides to get back to competitive action. There are no tournaments happening at the moment, so we are attracting a lot of people who are desperate to play in a community event. Due to the recent pandemic, we have had to scale down the size of the tournament, but we'll be making all the necessary safety precautions to ensure it will be a safe and enjoyable success. Entry is absolutely free, and teams have until September the 5th to register by emailing either Michael at kickoff@3.co.uk or Ashley at kickoff@3.co.uk. Now, this should have been Terry's third story, but unfortunately he's had some technical difficulties, so I'm going to read it for him. Verulamium Park set for £250,000 new playground. The wait is almost over, as work will soon begin on a £250,000 new children's playground in Verulamium Park. The attraction will include 30 features and will be divided into zones that reflect the city's rich history, such as a Roman-style basilica, a mini amphitheatre, a market street, and a main pathway named Watling Street. Among the features are a multi-seesaw, five-way swing, a battering ram group swing, stepping posts, two carousels, Roman numeral hopscotch, and a picnic area. The play area was designed by specialist firm Compan, which won a competitive tender with work scheduled to start on September the 14th. It will be placed on the site of three aging tennis courts close to the park's outdoor gym, mini golf and beach volleyball courts. The existing playground, which was installed around 25 years ago and had reached the end of its life, will be dismantled when the new one is completed around mid-November. This area of the park will then be grassed over and returned to its natural state. Community group Verulam at Play raised more than £60,000 of funds for the project. Additional funds for the project came from S106 payments given to park owners St Albans District Council by property developers and contributions from the City Neighbourhoods Committee. Councillor Anthony Rowlands, portfolio holder for Leisure, Heritage and Public Realm, said, "I'm delighted that this project has come to fruition after several years of campaigning and fundraising. We were aware for some time that the park was badly in need of a new play area, but the substantial amount of money needed to provide it was not available in our hard-pressed budget. Verulamium at Play helped immensely with an impressive local campaign and fundraising drive. Representatives from the group also joined a panel that chose the final design so that they were heavily involved in the whole process. I have studied the plans and have no doubt that this will be a very imaginative, interactive play area, packed with exciting and engaging features for children. It will be yet another reason for people to visit and enjoy this flagship park." Jessica Chivers from Verulamium at Play said, "Throughout the whole process we've been keen to ensure that the play area is inclusive and reflects our Roman heritage. We think the final design does that, and we're really excited about seeing children laughing, smiling and clambering all over the new kit. We hope it's a big hit."
Christmas Carnival cancelled. Harpenden Christmas Carnival, which is known to attract more than 18,000 people, has been cancelled for 2020 due to current government guidelines around coronavirus. Harpenden Town Council, which organises and runs the carnival, made the announcement on Thursday last week. Town Mayor Councillor Nicola Lineker said, "While we are disappointed we will not be able to bring this community event to life, we must do all we can to ensure the safety of Harpenden's residents and visitors." The annual Christmas lights will still be on display in Harpenden, and the scheduled farmers' market will go ahead on November the 22nd, with the Christmas carnival set to return to the High Street in 2021. A number of bookable festive workshops are currently being planned by the Town Council. More details will be announced in due course on the Town Council website.
It's Snow Patrol. Beatrix 9 takes to the slopes for disabled charity. A 9-year-old from Harpenden is doing a sponsored ski in aid of a charity which makes snow sports accessible for people with disabilities. Beatrix Ruffles was hoping to raise £150 for Disability Snow Sports UK, but she has already hit her target. She will be trying to beat the amount of times she can make it down the slope at Hemel Hempstead Snow Centre on August the 29th. Beatrix was due to go skiing with her family this year but could not go due to the pandemic. She had seen and heard about DSUK when skiing before, and it led her to realise that it must be very challenging for disabled people who don't get lots of opportunities in this area. The 9-year-old attends Harpenden 10th Brownies. Beatrix said, "Skiing is a really fun sport that I love. I'd be really sad not to be able to do it. It's exciting to speed down a slope, and I think it would be even more exciting if you couldn't normally do it. I'm going to do a sponsored ski. I'm going to try and beat my personal best of 21 runs in an hour. I'll be doing my sponsored ski at the Hemel Snow Centre. When I'm skiing, I feel happy and excited." Lizzie Ruffles, her mum, said, "We are so proud of Bea for coming up with this idea. We are delighted that she has raised all this money so far. It is a brilliant charity, and my friend's son has benefited from DSUK's work by being able to access snow sports. What is even more important to me as her mum is not the amount that is raised, but the fact that she took action because she would like to be able to impact the lives of children with disabilities. DSUK are very grateful to their supporters and say the pandemic has meant they have survived the worst crisis they have faced in their 45-year history. In order to ensure that everyone can access snow sports whilst managing the risks and financial impact associated with COVID-19, they are hoping to offer opportunities on dry slopes throughout the UK, as well as to continue a reduced service at indoor centres where it is safe and possible to do so. To sponsor Beatrix, you can go to https://www.justgiving.com/fundraising/B-sponsored-ski-2020.
City Salon reaches landmark 35th birthday after lockdown low time. Owners and staff at a St. Albans salon are celebrating 35 years in business and thank their clients after what has been a tough period. Sisters and business partners Maria Gaskin and Dominica Leto opened Hair Scene, now based in St. Peter Street, on August 19, 1985. Domenica told the Hearts ad, "It's amazing. I still remember the first day we opened and had one client. We were setting everything up on a Sunday, getting ready to open on the Monday, and this lady popped over and asked if we were open and if she could book. She still comes in to have her hair done now. It's been a long time and it's gone so quickly I can't believe it." Along with every other salon in the UK, Hair Scene had to close its doors in March due to the coronavirus outbreak. It was allowed to reopen on July the 4th, with extra safety measures in place, such as face coverings for staff and clients, extra cleaning, and providing hand sanitizer. The last few months have been really hard, Domenica continued. We had to close, but when we opened we were busy again straight away. Since lockdown, I think you appreciate having your hair done so much more. Looking back at the very early days of Hair Scene, Domenica shared the anecdote of how the sisters' faith helped them get their business loan. When we first started, we couldn't get a loan, she said. The last bank we tried was Barclays. The bank manager there was really nice, and he asked us, "What makes you think you'll succeed?" We said, "If God wants us to do it, we will do it." He said, "That was a bit of a different response to what he had heard before, but he gave us the loan." Since granting the business loan in 1985, the bank manager has kept in touch and sends the salon a birthday card every year. Maria and Domenica wanted to thank all of their customers, staff, and everyone who has supported them over the decades. The sisters added, "We thank God for enabling us to do this for so long and being with us this year. We appreciate all of our clients and staff, past and present, and appreciate everyone for helping the salon to get where it is." And now the list of people whose deaths were announced in this week's edition of the Hearts Advertiser. Joan Clack, aged 92 years. Joan Maunders, aged 89. Kathleen Moody, aged 93. John Went, aged 88. And Susan Wright, aged 68. Now, a little more of our piece of music by Goffby, and then we'll have our selection of interesting national radio programmes coming up this week.
And now for a look at this coming week's radio highlights. Starting with Saturday, August 29th. Tune in to Radio 4 for drama at 2:30pm for Agatha Christie's The Lie, a forgotten 1920s stage play, which didn't receive its stage premiere until 2018. Trapped in an unhappy marriage and provoked by her husband's obsession with her younger sister, Nan disappears from the family home for a night, with devastating consequences. Football fans may want to tune in to Talk Sport at 3pm for the Community Shield match between Arsenal, the FA Cup winners, and Liverpool, the title winners. Kickoff is at 4:30pm. Then at 7:15pm on Radio 4, Simon Sharma continues his great gallery tours. This week, the historian takes us on a tour of the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam. And over to Radio 3 at 9:15pm to hear a tribute to guitarist Julian Bream, who died recently. Sean Rafferty had travelled to Bream's home in Wiltshire to mark his 80th birthday and discuss with him a lifetime of music making. That's Sean Rafferty at home with Julian Bream, 9:15 on Radio 3. On Sunday, August 30th, in this week's edition of The Reunion at 11am, on Radio 4, Kirsty Walk takes us back to the heady days of the 2012 Olympics. In The Bid for London 2012, she reunites the team behind London's bid for the 2012 Olympic and Paralympic Games. It's repeated on Friday, September 4th at 9am. In Punt PI, the fact-based comedy series at 1:30 on Radio 4, Steve Punt is on the trail of the case of the missing Cézanne. Paul Cézanne's painting, near Auvers-sur-Oise, was stolen from Oxford's Ashmolean Museum, while the city celebrated the millennium and has not been seen since. Can he throw any light on this mystery? Then, still with Radio 4, the second and final part of the excellent drama Madam Will You Talk, dramatisation of Mary Stuart's romantic thriller set in the south of France in the early 1950s. Charity caught up in a plot to kidnap the schoolboy, David, flees to Marseille, where collaborators with the occupying Germans are still being hunted down and fugitive Nazis are living in disguise. Tune in to Radio 4 at 3 p.m. Finally, for Sunday, August 30th, and two BBC Proms programmes to choose from. At 7 p.m. on Radio 2, this week's Sunday night is Music Night. Looks back to the 2017 September BBC Prom, celebrating Stax Records. Music from singers William Bell, Eddie Floyd and Sam Moore, plus UK artists including Tom Jones, Ruby Turner, James Morrison, Beverly Knight, Jules Holland and his Rhythm and Blues Orchestra. Alternatively, on Radio 3 at 7:30, you can hear live from the Royal Albert Hall, with Simon Rattle conducting the LSO in a programme that explores the ideas of dialogue and space. It includes Elgar's Introduction and Allegro, Beethoven's Piano Sonata in C sharp minor, and Vaughan Williams' Symphony No. 5. Now for a look at some of those programmes which are broadcast each day at the same time. So Monday to Friday at the very same time every day. Book of the Week at 9:45 a.m. on Radio 4. Each day is Burning the Books, a history of the deliberate destruction of knowledge. Richard Overton, director of the Bodleian Libraries at Oxford, describes the deliberate destruction of knowledge held in libraries and archives, from ancient Alexandria to contemporary Sarajevo, from smashed Assyrian tablets in Iraq to the destroyed immigration documents of the UK Windrush generation. It's repeated each night at 12:30. The 15-minute drama on Radio 4 at 10:45 in the morning is Annika Stranded, Nick Walker's crime thriller in which the Oslo detective investigates a case involving a stone tiger, a flowering plant and an acupuncturist. Again, same time, 10:45, Monday to Friday. Over to Radio 3 at 12 noon for Composer of the Week. And this week, it's the largely forgotten piano prodigy and composer, Marie Zeil, born in 1846, and a revolutionary in both her teaching and piano playing. Then at just after midday, on Radio 4, again each day of the week, is a dramatisation of Elena Ferrante's The Lying Life of Adults. As Giovanna moves from childhood to adolescence in 1990s Naples, she becomes fascinated with her father's sister, Vittoria, from whom he is estranged. Finally, we come to A Small Town Murder at 7:45 p.m. each Monday to Friday on Radio 4, Scott Cherry's drama starring Mira Sayal as a West Midlands family liaison officer who solves crime and murder cases by winning the trust of those involved. Now for a look at those programmes on Monday, August 31st. We start with My Name Is at 11 a.m. on Radio 4, which looks at why black journalists are so underrepresented in Britain's newsrooms. It's repeated on Wednesday, September 2nd at 9 p.m. Starting at 12 noon on Classic FM comes the culmination of the Classic FM Movie Music Hall of Fame. Running through to 7 p.m, it's now time to reveal the film scores voted by thousands of Classic FM listeners and Radio Times readers that made it to the final. The top 10 will be revealed at 4 p.m. The drama at 2 p.m. on Radio 4 is Absent in the Spring by Agatha Christie, but written under the pseudonym of Mary Westmacott. It is 1934, and Joan Scudamore has become stranded in Mesopotamia while returning from a visit to her daughter in Baghdad. And the sudden solitude compels her to look back over her married life in rural England. My Dream Dinner Party returns to Radio 4 at 4 p.m, in which famous faces host a gathering of their heroes from beyond the grave, brought back to life through the radio archive. This week, actor Alison Steadman is joined by John Lennon, Beryl Reid, Anita Bruckner, James Stewart and Charles Aznavour. Finally, for Monday, August 31st, and the month, of course, another new series. A Short History of Solitude at 8 p.m. on Radio 4 explores the surprising history of being alone and discovers that many hermits and hideaways weren't always alone. That's repeated on Wednesday, September 2nd at 11 a.m. if you miss it on Bank Holiday Monday. On to Tuesday, September 1st, as we are in another new month and into autumn. My City in lockdown at 11 a.m. on Radio 4 looks at the last-minute decision to impose a lockdown across northern cities, with the result that Eid celebrations were curtailed. Fozia Hayat is a doctor on COVID wards in Bradford, but even she was shocked by this last-minute decision. She reports on the messages the authorities are sending out and what people are making of them. The drama at 2:15 p.m. is another Agatha Christie, written under the pseudonym of Mary Westmacott. In The Rose and the Yew Tree, a young woman is expected to marry her cousin Rupert, but she becomes seemingly intrigued by an ambitious working-class parliamentary candidate. Cricket fans will want to tune in to Radio 5 Live Sports Extra from 5:45 p.m. for commentary on England versus Pakistan in the third and final 2020 international at Old Trafford. Then over to Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. for tonight's live BBC Prom from the Royal Albert Hall. And it's the London Sinfonietta showcasing minimalist classics, including music by two giants of the 20th and 21st centuries, Steve Reich and Philip Glass. In Universities in Crisis on Radio 4 at 8 p.m, Sam Gimia explains whether the business and education models for Britain's higher education sector are fit for purpose. The COVID pandemic is significant, but when the crisis comes together with the issues that universities face over their funding and the impact of Brexit, it's clear this coming academic year will be like no other in living memory. If you miss it, it's repeated Sunday, September 6th at 5 p.m. And as it's a Tuesday, at 8:40 p.m. on Radio 4, In Touch with Peter White. Wednesday, September 2nd, the drama at 2 p.m. on Radio 4 is the second and final part of Power Out, the thriller by Sarah Woods. Sean's in trouble with the cyber crime police after a fake video is posted on social media. Front Row at 7:15 p.m. on Radio 4 includes an interview with Bernardine Evaristo, the 2019 Booker Prize winner for Girl, Woman, Other. The live BBC Prom on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. comes from the Media City in Salford. Omer Mia Welber conducts the BBC Philharmonic and works by Haydn the overture to his mythological opera Philemon and Baucis and Britain's Nocturne. Then at 8 p.m. on Radio 4 is another edition of Grounded with Louis Theroux. This week he chats with television presenter and mental health campaigner Gail Porter. Thursday, September 3rd, and two series coming to an end on Radio 4 are first The Intimate Monkey Cage at 9 a.m. This week, Brian Cox and Robin Ince are joined by Joe Brand, Ross Noble and Paul Nurse to examine the question of what life is and how it started. It's repeated at 9:30 p.m. on the same night, Thursday, September 3rd. And followed at 9:30 a.m. by the final episode of Laws That Aren't Laws. Robin Ince looks at Stigler's Law, the law that says all laws are named after the wrong person. The drama at 2:15 on Radio 4 is Keeping the Wolf Out by Philip Palmer. The death of a rock musician leads special investigator Bertalan Lazar to enter the uncharted territory of Budapest's underground drug scene. And you may prefer to tune into Radio 3's afternoon concert at 2 p.m. for another chance to hear the Prom from August 2019 at the Royal Albert Hall, in which the BBC singers, the New Civilization Orchestra, pianist Monty Alexander and Carleen Anderson, and the UK Vocal Assembly draw on Duke Ellington's famous three sacred concerts. And we round up this week on Friday, September 4th, starting with the Reenactment Radio at 11 a.m. on Radio 4, a programme in which people remake scenes from films they think they could improve on, including the scene in Titanic when Jack is freezing to death and Kate Winslet, playing Rose, is floating on a large piece of wood. Audiences everywhere are wondering why Rose just doesn't budge up. The drama at 2:15 on Radio 4 is The Summer Book, dramatisation of the 1972 novel by Tove Jansson. A woman and her six-year-old granddaughter, Sophia, spend a summer on a tiny Finnish island. They talk about life, nature, religion, everything about their feelings about the young girl's mother's death and their love for one another. Narrated by Sophia Jansen, the real-life model Sophia and the niece of Tove Jansen. 6:30 p.m. on Radio 4 comes a new series of the News Quiz, repeated on Saturday, September 5th at 10 past 1. And finally for Friday, September 4th, and this week's radio listings to Classic FM for the Classic FM concert with John Suchet. A showcase of fine recordings released in the last few months, including Chinese concert pianist Lang Lang's performance of the Goldberg Variations. Also works by Grieg, Bach and Elgar. May I wish you a peaceful, safe and enjoyable week of radio listening.
Now we have David Arson on the subject of what he calls Gregory's Gift.
Hello, David Arson here again with another musical half an hour or so. I'm going to call this one Gregory's Gift, and why will, I hope, become apparent as we go on. What comes to mind when you hear this? Example with which to start an introduction to plain song and chant, and see how it has left its mark on choral music throughout the centuries. When the monks chanted the psalms and other parts of the offices of the day, they started by writing the words and inflecting them, just making marks above the text which merely indicated whether the pitch went up or down. The chants therefore had a rather limited range, which probably suited the monks, and this system was really a mnemonic, an easy way of reminding the monks of tunes that they had already learned, rather than an accurate method of writing music. Eventually, there evolved just a single line, with the notes being either below, on or above it, and many ancient chants did in fact only use three notes. Here's a simple example, which adds one higher note, but is otherwise just the basic three notes.
Alleluia. Thy strength, O Lord, and come and help us. Alleluia. Alleluia.
Now, this all started in our country when Pope Gregory the Great sent a group of monks as missionaries to England in 596, under the leadership of Augustine. They landed in Kent and founded the great monastery of St. Peter and the Cathedral of Christ the King at Canterbury. Augustine became Archbishop of Canterbury, and one of the first things he did was to found song schools so that English men and boys could be trained as cantors. And for the next 1,000 years, many men and women followed the rule of St. Benedict in monasteries all over the country, until Henry VIII dissolved them. These monks, with Augustine, were teachers of the liturgy and the rites and chants to go with it. Plain song, or chant, has therefore become known as Gregorian chant, or plain song. Plainsong, as its name implies, began as a very simple musical language, for groups just to sing or chant together, monks, nuns and choirs. And this type of choral singing was very straightforward. Everyone sang the same tune, and it had no complicated rhythms, but the rhythm just followed the words. In the 11th century in Arezzo in Italy, a monk called Guido was obviously a brilliant teacher of singers. He taught them to sing by watching his hand. He stretched out four fingers horizontally and pointed either to the fingertips or the spaces between them. You can try this for yourself by holding out your left hand horizontally, putting the thumb across the palm, and taking a simple tune like Frère Jacques, and as you hum, whistle or sing it, start by touching the tip of the finger next to the little one, and as you sing each note, move up into the space, the next fingertip, and then the return to the starting place, so it'll go la 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 la. You get the general idea. I've got audiences to sing all sorts of tunes, including the national anthem, by this method. It's very simple and it works very well. Now, if we think of our fingers as lines on a page, we can put blobs on the lines or the spaces between them, and you have a basic music notation. You are reading music. The notes on these four-line staves were simply squares. You can see them on ancient manuscripts. They were called neumes. Now, of course, the range is somewhat greater. If we go from below the bottom finger to above the top finger, we have nine notes. Guido also taught his singers a song or chant about John the Baptist. It was in Latin, and it went like this.
Utque ant laxis resonare fibris, mira gestorum famulitorum, salve paludi labireatum, sancte Johannes.
Now, if I sing only the first syllable of each line, and hum the rest of the tune very quickly, you can see what Guido's pupils learnt.
Ut re mi fa so la sancte Johannes.
Ut re mi fa sol la eventually became another method of reading music known as tonic solfar, do re mi fa sol la, where each note of the scale has a separate syllable, not to mention giving us one of the best known songs from The Sound of Music. So now we have a greater range of notes available, the tunes can get a bit more interesting.
Amen.
This tune is still sung today, especially when a monk makes their vows or in cathedrals at ordination services when deacons and priests are ordained. The words asked for the gift of the Holy Spirit, Veni Creator Spiritus, come Creator Spirit. Now all the music we've heard so far has been in unison, everyone singing the same tune. But as I'm sure you will know, not all singers are comfortable at the same pitch. Sopranos and tenors have high voices, and altos and basses have low voices. This problem was solved initially by what is called organum. The same tune is sung by all, but at a convenient pitch. I don't mean any pitch you fancy, but at a predetermined pitch. So, the next sound we hear is of two parts, singing the same tune, but at an interval of a fifth. The high voice is up and the lower voice is down. This is a very short example, but gives you the sound. Then the next step was the independence of the parts. One stays still and the other moves, so that we have different intervals between the notes. And this is really the beginning of composing, literally putting with. Here is a simple example from Perrotin, an 11th century composer and therefore one of the first. Sounds quite ordinary to us, but remember that for hundreds of years all music had been monophonic, and only one note at a time, and to hear two notes at once was something completely new. The start of polyphonic music, many sounds at once. If it reminded you of a bagpipe, that's not surprising, for the bagpipe has a drone which plays just one note, and the tune is played on a chanter, a tube with holes which can play different notes like a recorder. So, this was a major step forward in musical history. Eventually, composers add rhythm to melody and can now stipulate the length of each note, and we get quavers, crotchets and minims. The stave, too, became five lines, so that the range is increased still further. A stave has a clef at the start of each line, a key, showing at what pitch the notes should be sung or played. So as well as a treble and a bass clef, which pianists use, we had a tenor clef to suit the pitch of a tenor voice, an alto clef to suit the higher voice, and these are generally known as C clefs because they show where the note in the middle C is. The treble clef is shaped rather like a G to show where the G is, and the bass clef is sometimes known as an F clef because it shows the position of the note F. Now, I'm sorry if that all seems a bit academic and technical, but I did want to give you a picture of how written music evolved. So, now let's look at what composers did with these ancient chants. Throughout the history of music, composers have been inspired by these old tunes, from the 15th century to the 21st century. Here, for example, is a piece written by William Byrd, working in Tudor times. He takes the melody of Christe qui luxes et dies, Christ who art the light and day, and after letting us hear the tune, he then writes five verses for five voices singing together, with the tune in a different part for every verse. After the first plainsong theme, we hear it in the bass part, then the baritone, then the tenor, so that by the last verse the tune is sung by the top part and easy to recognise. The tune sort of emerges from the music as we go through. Here's the plain song introduction and the first verse, and then with this has the tune in the bass part, and then the last verse with the tune more easy to hear as it's in the top part. Lovely evening service of Compline, the last monastic service of the day, when sung by a choir, sometimes includes motets, like the bird we heard just now. One of the most beautiful of these pieces is In Pace by William Blythman. In peace will I lay me down and take my rest. And this uses the plain song melody, here sung clearly by the men. You don't have to hunt for it. Here's the first half of the piece. Thank you. the 20th century, the French composer Maurice Duruflé was much influenced by ancient plainsong melodies and wrote four motets based on Gregorian themes. Here's one of them. It's called Ubi Caritas, Where God Is, There Is Love. And this not only uses the plainsong melody, but also has that rather melismatic or flowing feel to the way in which he uses the tune. Now let's finish with Duruflé's best-known work, his Requiem, and I've chosen the version with orchestra rather than just with organ, as it is most usually heard. There is that lovely feel of the plainsong melodies, but also his deft use of orchestral colour. We'll hear the introduction and Kyrie. I hope you've enjoyed this brief foray into the history of written music and how plain song is in some sense still with us today. Thank you for listening.
Now we have our piece of music, Travel Light by Gothby, in its entirety. And finally, here are some well-known people whose birthdays fall this week. On the 30th of August, 1797, Mary Shelley, author of Frankenstein and wife of the poet Percy Shelley, was born in London. On the 31st of August, 1932, Roy Castle, jazz trumpeter and television presenter of Record Breakers for 21 years, was born near Holmfirth in Yorkshire. On the 1st of September, 1875, Edgar Rice Burroughs, author of Tarzan of the Apes, was born in Chicago, Illinois. On the 2nd of September 1937, Derek Folds, the actor best known for playing Bernard Woolley in Yes Minister, was born in London, and he died in January this year. On the 3rd of September 1875, Ferdinand Porsche, the German automotive engineer who not only designed cars under his own name, but was also responsible for the Volkswagen Beetle and others, was born in Mafersdorf, in Bohemia, in what is now the Czech Republic. On the 4th of September, 1824, Anton Bruckner, the composer, was born near Linz, in Austria. And on the 5th of September, 1847, Jesse James, American bank and train robber, was born in Kearney, Missouri. In 1882, after a long career of wrongdoing, and with a bounty of $5,000 on his head, he was shot and killed at the age of 35. Some notable events which happened this week in the past. On the 30th of August, 1916, Ernest Shackleton, the great explorer, completed the rescue of his crew on Elephant Island near Antarctica. After his ship, the Endeavour, had been lost in pack ice, his expedition found themselves on Elephant Island. With a few of his colleagues, he sailed in an open boat 800 miles to South Georgia, while the rest remained on the island. He eventually found a ship and returned to save every man that had started out on the expedition. On the 31st of August, 1997, Diana, Princess of Wales, was killed in a car crash in a tunnel in Paris. Her driver and her friend Dodi Fayed were also killed. On the 1st of September 1985, a joint American-French expedition, led by Professor Robert Ballard, discovered the wreck of RMS Titanic, 370 miles southeast of the coast of Newfoundland. On the 2nd of September 1666, the Great Fire of London began. It burned for 4 days and is estimated to have destroyed the homes of 70,000 of the city's 80,000 inhabitants. On the 3rd of September, 1752, Britain adopted the Gregorian calendar, losing 11 days. So Wednesday, the 2nd of September, was immediately followed by Thursday, the 14th of September. This caused riots where people demanded that the government give them back the 11 days of their lives which they believed had been stolen from them. On the 4th of September, 1682, the English astronomer Edmund Halley first observed the comet named after him. However, he wasn't the first person to observe it, as it was recorded as early as 240 BCE in China. And on the 5th of September 1997, Mother Teresa, the Albanian nun and Nobel Peace Prize winner, who devoted much of her life to helping the sick and poor, died in Kolkata, aged 87. And with that, we finish this programme. Many thanks to Terry, Leslie and Wendy for reading with me today, to Angela who provided the radio listings, and to John who read them, to Mark who makes all the copies of the programme, and to Michelle who ensures you get yours. And of course, we'll be back again next month. But that's all from News Extra in August 2020. Goodbye.